Hi everyone, I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia, and I'm here to try and give an overview of steps 4 and 5. So I'm going to use the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm looking right at the bottom of page 63. It's right after a person takes a third step. And I think this is so important because they are telling us in step 4, we're going to do a searching and fearless moral inventory. But we can't do it until we've taken a third step, until we've surrendered our entire life to God. Because if I'm going to do an inventory without God's help, I'm just doing self-therapy, and that doesn't work. So, right after we take our third step, it says, next. We launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. And then it says, and I love this line, though our decision to commit our lives to God was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect. So they're telling us recovery can be permanent. It can have little permanent effect unless followed by a strenuous effort. That means hard work, not 5 minutes a day, a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom. So often I would think food was my problem, that I worshiped food. But they're telling me no, food was a symptom. It was my character defects. It was my self-will that blocked me off from God. And when I was blocked off from God, I had no defense against the food coming in. So they're telling me that I need to inventory myself. I need to look at all the different defects that I have so that in steps 6 and 7, God can come in and remove them. I always thought that was really cool, that it's my job to inventory my defects, to share them with another person in step 5, but then it's God's job to come in and move them. I mean, God could have said, Janet, you created this mess, you clean it up, and I'll be waiting for you when you're done. But he doesn't. He's such a good God that he says, I know you made this mess. But I know that you can't clean it up by yourself. So you do some work and I will help you clean it up. What a great God we have. So it tells us on page 64 that resentment is the number one offender. Resentment is the number one, fruit of this illness. Back in a few pages before, it says selfishness and self-centeredness. That we think is the root of the illness. So roots are below a ground. You don't see them, but we see the fruit. And the fruits of this illness are resentments, fears, and harms to others. So they're saying the first thing we have to look at is resentments. And on page 64, they tell us when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Early in OA, I just wanted the magic food plan so I could straighten out physically. It didn't work. I spent 6.5 years in Overeaters Anonymous not getting better because I was trying to get well physically, but I didn't have the power. I had no power. So they're telling me when the spiritual malady is overcome, then I get better spiritually and physically. So again, the first thing I had to do is come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, surrender my whole life to that power, not just my food, but my whole life. And now I'm cleaning up my past. So the first thing they tell me I have to clean up is my resentments, and that I make a list and I look for my part. And before I look for my part, right, I think a lot of us know how to do the columns, who we resent, why, and what it affects. But before we go on, we pray, God, save me from being angry. Just like I needed to be rescued from the food, I need to be rescued from my own anger. Again, I need to bring prayer into it. I need to bring God into it. Otherwise, I'm just doing self-therapy. And it says we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. We looked for our part. Where was I wrong? And I can only do this because I've surrendered my life to God. And I believe that a loving God has my back. And it's okay if I admit that I've done something wrong because God's got my back and he's going to help me. So I look at my resentments and then I look at my fears. And I'm going to read what the big book says about fears on page 67. It says, "This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve." Okay, they're saying that fear is evil. I used to think that fear was just an emotion, but no one ever would say that being happy or being sad was good or evil. Why are they talking about fear as evil? And they go even further. They say it's set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune. It's set in motion bad things. Well, how could that be? And I think what they're saying is behind fear is a spiritual power and not a good one. Think about our second step. Our second step says, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. That means that when I come to believe that God can restore me to sanity, it actually sets things in motion in the spiritual world, and God can start restoring me to sanity. My faith actually allows God to act. But if I have fear, that means I'm not having faith in God. I'm having faith in whatever is the opposite. And that opposite brings me misfortune I felt I don't deserve. So that's why it's so important for us to get rid of fears. And so they even say on page 68, we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Stealing, I mean, we can get put in jail for stealing, but they're saying fear is even worse. So, okay, now they're telling us how to get rid of it, which now we see is so important. And it says, we reviewed our fears, we put them on paper, we asked ourselves why we had them. So we drill down and to say, why do I really have this fear? So here's an example. When my daughter was 16, I was afraid of disciplining her. And so, if I were to drill down, like my fear is disciplining my daughter. Why do I have this fear? So, I thought if I discipline my daughter, then once she's 18 and leaves the house, she'll never talk to me again. And then I'll be alone and lonely on holidays for the rest of my life. So then I look at the dishonest thinking there, which is disciplining a child appropriately doesn't mean they'll never talk to you again. I ask God to remove the fear and I ask him what he would have me do, which in that case is discipline my daughter appropriately. My daughter is now 22 and we have a great relationship. So me telling her I couldn't do whatever it was she wanted to do when she was 16 didn't harm me. Didn't harm our relationship. Then something really beautiful they tell us. They say, we are now on a different basis. I'm not on the basis of trying to get what I want, to try to make sure that everything is fair. I'm on the basis of trusting and relying upon God. This is page 68. It tells me we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. And here is a formula for serenity. It says, we are in the world to play the role that He, God, assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity? So they're saying, I can have serenity even if there's calamity going on all around me. And if I don't have serenity, I have to look at two things. Where am I not doing what I think God would want me to do? And where am I not relying on Him humbly? And if I'm doing what I think God wants me to do and humbly relying on Him, I don't have to have fear. And then the next thing we do after we do our fear inventory is we do our sex inventory. We go back over our past relationships and look at our conduct, where we were selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. Who did we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? What could we have done instead? Often it was, the answer would be not gotten involved. And then it says we create a sex ideal. We pray and meditate and ask God to mold our ideals. And it says we can consult with other people, but ultimately it's between God and us. They tell us God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. It says we avoid hysterical thinking or advice. And I think that goes for all things, not just forming our sex ideal. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice about religion, about politics. We're very careful in how we advise other people. So on page 70, it continues to talk more about the sex ideal. And it says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does that mean we're going to get drunk? And they say, maybe. They say, if we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. I think that's really important because a lot of times people say that if someone eats compulsively, well, it's a step one issue. You have to go all the way back to the beginning. But here they're saying if we continue to harm others and we're not sorry, we are going to drink or we are going to eat compulsively. So I think it's important that if I'm sponsoring someone and she's breaking her sex ideal or engaging in some behavior that's harming others, the worst thing I could do is say, go get a new sponsor and start over at step one. The best thing I could do is to say, stop harming others and make sure you're following your ideal. So we go through and we have this whole written inventory. And it says, when we're done, we've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about ourselves. That's not fun. This often isn't a fun process, but it does have a promise. It says, we have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. So those are the fruits of step four. So on to step five. It tells us why we have to do a fifth step. Admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. First, it says, I'm trying to get a new attitude. I'm trying to change, to not be such a self-centered person. But look at the second reason they give us. I'm trying to get a new relationship with my creator. See, this program isn't about believing in God. It's about having a relationship with him. And this step is going to help me. And the third thing, it says, it's to help me with the obstacles in my path. What are the character defects that are blocking me from my new relationship with my creator? It says, okay, I've already started to see what my defects are. Now they're about to be cast out. Remember, God does the casting out. That's how much he loves us. He casts out. And they tell us why we can't skip this step. They say, if we skip this step, we may not overcome drinking. We may not stop binging. The text says that when people try to avoid this humbling experience, almost invariably, they get drunk. Having persevered with the rest of this program, they wondered why they fell. How come they fell? By not disclosing everything. because they're not honest, right? We are people who have to be honest. We can't keep deep, dark secrets. The book says that we're people who generally do keep secrets, but they say that we can't. Dishonesty by omission is still dishonesty. So if I leave something out, I'm dishonest. At the top of page 73, it says these people wondered why they fell. If we're in relapse, we should always know why we fell, what caused us to relapse. Not doing a thorough fifth step, disclosing everything, is a cause of relapse. And in the AA 12 and 12, they talk about all the different consequences of avoiding step five. They say irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression. So if we're feeling any of these things, we can ask ourselves, is there anything I'm keeping hidden that I should be disclosing? In the 12 and 12, they say, most of us would declare that without a fearless admission of our defects to another human being, we could not stay sober. It seems plain that the grace of God will not enter to expel our destructive obsessions until we are willing to try this. I mean, I think that's a strong statement, but what beautiful imagery. The grace of God enters to expel my destructive obsessions. It's always important for me to remember that it's the grace of God that removes my obsession, not any work that I might do. If there's a big hurricane and my house is flooded and the sheriff is coming around with a bullhorn saying, "Get to the roof so the helicopters can rescue you," my job is to climb up to the roof so that I can get on that helicopter. I can't just say, "Pick me up by my front door. I'll drown if I do that." But let me never be so arrogant as to say that I rescued myself. All I did was climb to the roof so that I could be rescued. These 12 steps just put us in a position so that we can be rescued. So the big book goes on to say that the alcoholic, or for us, the compulsive eater, is revolted by what he does on his sprees. It says, coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. Vaguely, we can't be vague. We can't have these boogeymen in the closet. We can't say, I was kind of not so nice in the past. We need to be very specific. I stole from Susie. I cheated from Joe. I was nasty to Sally. Why? Because if I don't get these things out, the book tells us that we end up pushing these memories far inside ourselves, which leads to constant fear and tension, which leads to more drinking or binging. Fear and tension, mental and emotional drain. Then the chapter continues by saying, psychologists generally don't have success with us because we're generally not honest with them. And they keep hammering home honesty, saying we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long and happily in this world. So I want to say a few things about honesty that I wish someone had told me in my first 6.5 years of OA when I couldn't stop binging. Basically, if we are not honest, we are not going to recover. It doesn't matter how many meetings, phone calls, food plans, how much service we do. If we are not honest, it's like we're taking a big black pen and writing the words, "Keep out, God," across our hearts. God won't coexist with dishonesty. Ways we're often dishonest is with our sponsors, right? Sometimes about food. We lie by omission when we don't tell them things we know we should. Or even not about food. We all know the things we should say. And think about it. If I'm dishonest with my sponsor, I've made an idol, a false god out of my sponsor, thinking that my relationship with my sponsor is what's going to get me recovered. But a sponsor's job is to help me get a relationship with God. I'm better off being honest with no sponsor than dishonest with a sponsor. For people like us, it means no lies, no cheating on husbands, no cheating on taxes. We are people who have to live in a way that is rigorously honest. So, step five promises. It says that once we do this, we get these great promises. It says we become conscious of his presence. That means we start realizing, oh, yeah, there really is a God. And he's not just up there in the clouds somewhere. He didn't just create the universe and now is spending the rest of eternity watching Netflix. It says we begin to lose our fear. We begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter, we're reborn. Those are all promises of the third step. And now we get even more in the fifth step. It says we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. I mean, that was my experience. I felt as if I'd been nearsighted all my life and someone gave me a pair of glasses. Trees just looked greener. That's the best way I can describe it. It says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. What a great visual it is. I was in Aruba recently and we would come back from the beach and brush off our bathing suits and the sand would just fall from us. That's what happens here. Our fears fall from us. And then this, we begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. So, not just an awareness, we know that He's near us. So, whether I'm going through stress or surgery or the pain of rejection, God is right near me. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs. That was me. I was never an agnostic. I always believed in God, but I treated God like a genie in a bottle. Come out here, do my wish, remove my food obsession, make this boy like me, or whatever it was, then go back in your bottle and leave me alone. God was a genie, or God was a Santa Claus that I would give my list to. But this changes. It says now we begin to have a spiritual experience, not just a belief. If I'm a diabetic and I believe in insulin, but I never inject it, it doesn't do me any good. We had beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. God is rewiring my heart to make my priorities more like his priorities, to take away my selfishness and give me care and concern for others. Then it says, the feeling that the drink problem, or for us, the food problem, has disappeared, will often come strongly, often. So I take that to mean that more than 50% of the time, we are not obsessing about food. It says, we feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And then the 12 and 12 have some more fifth step promises that I think are really cool. On page 57 of the AA 12 and 12, it tells us that we are people who are tortured by loneliness, and that when we do this step, we begin to get rid of that loneliness. Oh yes, the book tells us the fellowship helps us in a social sense, but even with the fellowship, we still suffer many of the old pains of anxious apartness. That was me. I could be in a room with 100 people and feel like I was the only person on the planet. And what's the solution? The 12 and 12 gives the answer so clearly. Step five is the answer. It was the beginning of true kinship with man and God. And the promises keep coming. On page 58 of the AA 12 and 12, it says, we began to get the feeling that we could be forgiven no matter what we had thought and done. When I told my sponsor all the horrible things I've thought and done, and she just looked at me the same way, lovingly, the same way, then I start to feel maybe I can be forgiven. And the book also tells us that often while working on this step, we first feel able to truly forgive others. So we start knowing that we can receive forgiveness and give forgiveness. Another thing the AA 12 and 12 tells us, it tells us we start getting more humility. And I love the definition here. They define humility as a clear recognition of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could. And then another promise. See, the promises just keep coming. It says that only by discussing ourselves, holding back nothing, only by being willing to take advice and accept direction, could we set foot on the road to straight thinking, solid honesty, and genuine humility. Like, pretty interesting. Straight thinking. We can think straight. But remember, in chapter 5 of the big book, it says once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So by me doing this spiritual work, my thinking starts to straighten out. And then the chapter in the AA 12 and 12 ends by saying that after step 5, we start moving toward a full and meaningful sobriety. I love that word toward. We get to a point where we're no longer running from food. We're running toward a full and meaningful sobriety, toward an ever-deepening love relationship with God, toward a better way of helping others. We're not running away from, we're running toward. And if there's someone who's sitting here today who isn't even sure that there is a God to run toward, I think you can start with a maybe prayer. And it might go something like this: God, I don't know if you're there. And if you're there, I don't know if you care about me. But if you're there and if you care, I need help. And the worst that could happen is that you're talking to dead air. But what if there really is a God? What if there is? And what if that prayer is a catalyst that allows God to start a renovation project in our hearts so that we have a spiritual experience, so that He begins to change our souls in such a way that our plans and priorities become more like His plans and priorities? And when that happens, the food obsession doesn't stand a chance because really and truly, the age of miracles is still with us. And steps 4 and 5 are just two steps on the journey to get closer to God and get better able at serving our fellows. And with that, I will pass. Thank you.